voices and persons and community to have voice and safety and place. Janet reminded us earlier that we are called to truth building. Santiago Curl called earlier and reminded us of those who went before us and who we admire. Today, do something that is honorable and follow the legacy and the words and wisdom of Maya Angelou. I am Cecil Prescott. Thank you for listening to More Talk Radio on your community radio station, KBOO FM. Continue to be a supporter of this radio station, and I will be with you next time. Take care and have a pleasant day.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, KBOO, Portland.
KBOO's board is recruiting directors. In preparation for our annual board election in September, KBOO's nominating committee will be holding virtual information sessions from now through June. KBOO's Board of Directors guides the station's strategic plan and represents the interests and visions of all our members. BIPOC persons are especially encouraged to apply. More information and meeting times can be found at kboo.fm/board recruiting. Thank you for considering board work at KBOO.
Rev up your support for KBOO Community Radio. Have an old car taking up space? Donate it to KBOO. Your unused vehicle can become music to our ears, powering independent radio that amplifies diverse voices and community perspectives. It's easy and hassle-free. Either visit kboo.fm/cars or call 1-877-KBOO-123. You'll get a tax deduction and the satisfaction of supporting local, independent media. Donate your car to KBOO Community Radio today and drive change in your community.
Wish I was a mole in the ground. Wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root this mountain down. Wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. That was Eric Bibb doing the Old Mole song. This is Desiree Helligers, and I'll be your host for today's Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. First up on today's show, Gaza and the International Criminal Court. The International Criminal Court, or ICC, and the International Court of Justice, ICJ, have been in the news in recent months for their decisions against Israel and its war in Gaza. In their Left and the Law segment, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker talk about the history of these two courts and the differences in their authority to hold international actors to justice. Jan and Mike review recent actions by the ICJ against Israel and discuss the political implications of the court's decision for the broader movement for justice in Palestine. Then, mask bans and COVID-19. North Carolina legislators have passed a comprehensive mask ban, and politicians elsewhere are pushing to criminalize masking in public space as part of ongoing suppression of political dissent and the extension of police power. Fran Michel discusses this attack on our rights, our bodily autonomy, our privacy, and our health, drawing on material from sources including the Death Panel podcast and the People's CDC, who remind us that, quote, we all have responsibility to fight this attack on our rights, our bodily autonomy, our privacy, and our health. If you stop masking, now is a good time to re-engage with this practice in public spaces and particularly in political gatherings. If you're organizing an event, please require and distribute high-quality masks as visible expressions of solidarity. Unquote. Then, anti-trans genocide. With June 12th marking the 8th anniversary of the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando, Florida, that left 49 people dead and 53 injured, we bring excerpts from a talk that trans activist Ash DeBuse gave on April 19th at WSU Vancouver, in which they argue that anti-trans violence, transphobic hate speech, legislation, and attempts to erase trans identity, culture, and history in the U.S. collectively constitute an unfolding genocide. Following Dean Spade, they argue that, quote, LGBTQ plus advocacy that focuses on rights as a framework for safety and liberation are feeding and reproducing the same systems that actively harm queer people. And then finally, the Irish famine. Larry Bodlin brings a review of Jacqueline O'Mahony's novel about the 1849 famine in Ireland, Sing, Wild Bird, Sing, a song of leaving and finding the Oregon territories and a different sort of wanderer. The novel is sad and lovely, informative and entertaining. So that's the lineup for today's Old Mole Variety Hour. And we begin this morning with Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker talking about Gaza and the International Criminal Court.
Well, Mike, let's talk today about Israel's war in Gaza and actions by the international courts. Both the International Criminal Court, ICC, and the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, have been in the news quite a bit recently for their decisions on Israel and its war in Gaza. We'll be talking today about the South Africa case before the ICJ, but let's also talk first about the ICC and its arrest warrants on Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on charges of war crimes and crimes against humanity over the October 7th attacks on Israel and subsequent war in Gaza. This is the first time that the ICC has targeted a top leader of a close ally of the United States. So, Mike, tell us a little bit about these two international courts, the differences between them, and their reach.
Well, the International Court of Justice has been around for since the end of the 19th century. It was actually started by the Tsar of Russia. It sort of staggered along, not really bearing much significance in any of the disputes of the day, became part of the League of Nations, and then was really resurrected after World War II as part of the UN. And it and the ICC are really the only big UN institutions that are not based in New York. They're both based in The Hague in the Netherlands, and they're very different. The ICJ is the way states can sue each other and get what were generally thought to be civil remedies. But it's what happened when South Africa sued Israel. It was one state and suing another state, both of which had agreed to have disputes resolved by the ICJ, because it's been a very important institution, the premier international legal institution for some time. The ICC, the International Criminal Court, didn't really get cooking until 2002. It is targeted against individuals. It's supposed to be like a criminal court, and in which people of some international infamy can be actually prosecuted and imprisoned. And it has had a rocky career, because since 2002, there have been, according to Amnesty International, of the 54 people who've been prosecuted, 47 of them have been from Africa. So it's taking on, it could be like a criminal court in South Los Angeles or Chicago, where all the adjudicators are illustrious Westerners and all the people in the dock are black. So its reputation has taken a hit. They've had a few Serbians sprinkled in the series of African dictators that have had to stand in the dock as individuals. So it's a huge deal. It's really big for Netanyahu and for anyone in Israel's establishment to be individually named, as were leaders of supposedly rogue African states.
And apparently the most concrete legal consequence is the possibility of arrest when Netanyahu arrives on the shores of other countries that honor the arrest warrant. But this is apparently not likely to happen, that he would be arrested by governments on countries where he landed. But is it more of a prestige and moral decision than something with legal teeth?
Yeah, well, it's a risk for him. Putin also has the same. He's been individually indicted by the ICC. And, you know, Spain, for example, has arrested people who landed there. Like Pinochet was charged by the ICC. So it has added an element of risk to his life. And it's not clear. Like 98 countries have endorsed the action of the ICC, the prosecutor. And what the prosecutor said is very eloquent. He said, when he indicted leaders of Hamas and leaders of Israel, "Let's be clear on one core issue. If we do not demonstrate our willingness to apply the law equally, if it is seen as being applied selectively, we will be creating the conditions for its collapse. In doing so, we will be loosening the remaining bonds that hold us together, the stabilizing connections between all communities and individuals, the safety net to which all victims look in times of suffering. This is the true risk we face in this moment. Now more than ever, we must collectively demonstrate that international humanitarian law, the foundational baseline for human conduct during conflict, applies to all individuals and applies equally across the situations addressed by my office and the court. This is how we will prove tangibly that the lives of all human beings have equal value." Now that's the prosecutor, Karim Khan.
They're the usual defenders and critics, as one would expect, of the decision and the court itself, the legitimacy of the court, including the United States, the White House, even though the Biden administration approved of the decision, their decision around Putin and his war in Ukraine. Are there any critics of the ICC decision that you would give some weight to?
Not really, because Karim Khan, the case he made, like the case South Africa presented to the ICJ, the other court, is impeccable. I mean, his decision is called morally repugnant, it's called anti-Semitic, but he's got withering personal attacks aimed at him. But his facts have not seriously been disputed. When South Africa made charges of genocide, they quoted hundreds of quotes from Israel officials, Israel leaders, essentially saying these people are animals. We need to clear them all out. Israel is now being looked at, even scrutinized, in ways it has never, ever been held to account for what it's said or done in the past.
And even though Israel has come before these courts over the years for the settlements and occupation of Palestinian lands.
Well, they have been indicted for those, and they've defended themselves. But basically, they've never been accountable criminally, and they've never been sued collectively and charged with genocide. They've been charged with violating international law. But a charge of genocide is a whole other animal. It's a very serious charge. It's hard to imagine any charge more serious. And South Africa has done just a remarkable job. They've not only been brilliant, they've been very professional, they've been meticulous and documented everything they say, and they've been persistent. They've continued to follow up with their initial December 2023 charge against Israel. They followed up in February. They followed up asking Israel to be blocked from attacking the dense community in the south of Gaza, Raha. They're on the case, and there's been just a remarkable confluence of other events, all the student demonstrations, all the other expressions in the United States, around the world, that have put Israel in the dock in ways they've never had to be examined before.
In returning to the South Africa case before the International Court of Justice, can you highlight some of the important legal junctures there? It's quite a lengthy document, and they've submitted briefs periodically. Israel has responded with, as I understand it, the reports requested by the court. Can you take us through some of the critical junctures in that pathway through that court?
Okay, well, in December of 2023, South Africa alleged that Israel had committed and was committing genocide against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, against the Genocide Convention, to which both South Africa and Israel had signed. South Africa described Israel's, quote, 75-year apartheid, 56-year occupation, 16-year blockade of the Strip prior to the genocidal actions. It asked that the ICJ take provisional measures, including the immediate suspension of these operations by Israel. And Israel said these charges are baseless. They said the country was functioning as the legal arm of Hamas. It said it was conducting a war of self-defense following the Hamas-led attack on October 7th.
Can I ask you, Mike, about the relevance of that history? Israel argues, and I think it's continued to argue before this court, that their responses were all defensive, that Gaza's citizens sit on a very elaborate military structure and tunnel. They've tried to limit casualties. These are some of their basic arguments in defense. My impression is that the South Africa case did depend on history prior to October 7th to argue for the intent of genocide rather than October 7th and subsequent events. How important was that to their case?
Well, it was important in that Israel would have history begin with October 7th, and the South Africans made clear that the occupation of Gaza, which was called by the English Prime Minister an open-air prison, had been going on for a long, long time. There was a context for those actions. But they, primarily at Israel's actions, like Israel, they pointed out that Israel bombed and destroyed effectively 12 universities. They bombed cemeteries. They were systematically eliminating the whole infrastructure. These acts, they have nothing to do with conducting acts of self-defense. It's true that it's a dense place and that Hamas, if they have any sense, are going to try to mingle as well as hide. But and that places constraints on Israel. But Israel has not bothered to try and constrain their desire or their expressions to effectively eliminate the Palestinians from Gaza. That is, in fact, their goal. It has long been their goal, but has never been expressed as much. And the United States has always been an unwavering supporter of Israel, but there's a division here between those who support its most imperialistic aims and those who want to combine with the rest of the world and support Israel, the version that existed before 1967, that has found the settlements, for example, to be in violation of UN resolutions and international law.
So with these periodic reports filed, Israel filing their response, the back and forth of all of that, what is the likely trajectory of this case as it continues to go forward and Gaza itself is slowly strangled in the meantime?
Well, both Israel and Palestine are being slowly strangled. I mean, Palestine continues to be subjected to murderous random activity, and there's a starvation is now widespread. They're food and water is being systematically withheld. Israel,
meanwhile, on the occupied West Bank, there are hundreds of Palestinians killed by settlers, defended by the IDF, and seizure of land. So that's kind of the backstage horror show of it as well.
Exactly. All that's going on. But we are watching that go on. And no one has ever been that interested in the details of Israel's systematic absorption of the West Bank or of Gaza until now. You know, there are people watching what Israel officials say. There are meticulous records being kept. The South Africa has presented hundreds of remarks of Israel officials indicating a desire to get rid of all Palestinians, saying that there's no such thing as a civilian. They're all equivalent to members of Hamas, either now or in the future. Remarks that they're animals and we will act accordingly. These kind of statements have been made for years, but nobody's ever recorded them and assembled them in the way that South Africa did or the way that other people are now. And Israel is systematically losing face, losing respect, losing connections, losing university affiliations. It's suffering economically.
Yeah, even in Intel, apparently the largest employer in Israel withdrew a $60 billion plan to build a new plant for chips.
Yeah, that's remarkable, because Intel has been maybe the major corporation, and by major, I mean one of the very top corporations in this country, very large, and also manufacturing what everyone agrees are critical items for the future, even microchips that are found. They're going to not only in houses and cars, but they're going to be in your shoes. Intel has always been very intimately connected to Israel and did indeed have like a multi-billion-dollar plan for expansion there.
They claim it's a routine business decision, but they were also the focus of a pretty intense BDS campaign because of the war.
And indeed, and that's happening all over Israel. So it's kind of a hellbound race to the bottom for both Palestine and Israel right now, with everyone in the world watching them.
Returning to the International Court of Justice, what do you see ahead for that court and its jurisdiction?
Well, the most recent activities, I think, are in March, following a second request by South Africa for additional measures. The ICJ ordered new emergency measures, ordering Israel to ensure basic food supplies without delay, as Gazans face famine and starvation. And on May 24th, by 13 votes to 2, as opposed to the previous unanimous decision, the court ordered an immediate halt to Israel's offensive in Rafah. And while there was a consensus among legal experts that the order required Israel to halt its offensive immediately, Israel rejected that position and has continued with its offensive operations. It's somewhat constrained by the lack of neighborhood-busting bombs that Biden has caused, but they're continuing, and it looks like South Africa will be watching all the way, and each time, periodically, if there's decisive junctures, we can expect further motions to be brought. And we yet to know whether there's going to be an active prosecution initiated, or what the response to the prosecutor's request will be for the issuance of warrants.
What about the U.S.'s funding this genocide? Is the United States at risk of coming before the ICJ for sponsoring and funding this war knowingly?
Well, that could happen. And I think it's, you know, there will be a significant effect from this elections. I know that Genocide Joe has been in many ways complicit and even indispensable to what Israel's doing. But Trump is yet another animal. I mean, Netanyahu has slept in his son-in-law, Jared Kushner's, bed when he visited the United States. Trump immediately.
Literally and in so many other ways that we don't want to even think about. These are cozy cousins.
Trump wants to, expel and
open up condos on the Mediterranean there in Gaza.
Yeah, that's exactly what he wants to do. He wants to support everyone else. That's his base, his Christian Zionist nationalists are a critical part of his base. And he's also connected with the most rabid right-wing Jews. And he will do everything he can to further Israel's designs, which are squarely rejected by most of the world. So there is a difference, even though what we see now is terrifying. The United States is an essential ingredient of what Israel's doing. But as is so often the case, the bottom can be far lower than it is now.
So in terms of even voting, much less campaigning for Biden, I mean, we're all between a rock and a hard spot with these guys. And I think it is about, for many in the resistance to the occupation and the oppression of Palestinians, it's about U.S. role in maintaining itself as an empire, the role of Israel for the U.S. and its own imperial reach and hegemony in the world that's been shaken in recent decades. But I think that's part of these protests as well, is protesting the U.S. and its vast network of arms and military bases and military spending. Israel is the biggest recipient, but there are for sure others as well.
Well, I think the ICC and the ICJ have been really huge in establishing what's acceptable in the world, what's normal in the world. Their equation of the Hamas and of Israel's leaders now is profound, as is all the student demonstrations have been amazing. I mean, on the one hand, you can say in Vietnam, students were looking out for themselves because they could have been drafted. But here, it's not really, people are demonstrating in universities like Columbia and UCLA, Harvard, Yale, and Michigan, and all over the country, in Cal State, in Los Angeles, in San Francisco. And these are people who are paying huge amounts of money, who are actually being expelled. They're taking big chances and are being severely punished because so much of the, there are so many sources of funding for universities that come from people who are engaged in creating and supporting and expanding Israel.
And so, and the U.S. military campuses, all of the anti-war movements and actions on campuses have in some way involved challenge to the U.S. military.
So there is a big confluence all over the world that we've never before seen. And I have no idea how far it will go, but the train is out of the station. Names are being taken. Actions are being scrutinized. And Israel's never had to endure that before.
So there are glimmers of genuine hope and possibility in these dark nights.
Exactly. There's real possibilities that have opened up. But at the same time, there could also be a genocide. I mean, literally.
Well, thanks, Mike. This is Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker talking today about the International Criminal Court and the International Court of Justice and their cases against Israel. طلعت علي البنت هاي من فوق لتحت حكت شوف الاختلاف انا احلامك حياتك اللي فيها كل شي بتتمنيه فيها عيونك الحلوات بتحب تشوف تعالي جربي خلي راسك مرتاح بعيد عن الهموم غمضت عيوني رجعت للظلم العايش فيه الواقع اللي مربطني في الحركة والتفكير.
That was Bala Hadood or Without Borders from Atija, an all-women's rap group living and recording in a refugee camp in the West Bank. And before that, you heard Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker on Gaza and the International Criminal Court. Next up, Fran Michel on mask bans and COVID-19.
In 2020, when the pandemic caused by the SARS-CoV-2 virus was recognized in the U.S., there were laws in force penalizing people for wearing face coverings in 18 states and the District of Columbia, as well as some more local jurisdictions. These laws had varied histories. North Carolina's 1953 anti-mask law was a response to Ku Klux Klan activity, though mainly because the Klan made defending segregation less respectable. New York State's anti-mask law dated to 1845, when it was passed to suppress anti-rent protests in which Hudson Valley tenant farmers were demanding land reform. North Dakota's law came in 2017 during protests against the Dakota Access Pipeline. As these examples indicate, the role of these laws has mainly been to suppress progressive political activity. State anti-mask laws have had various provisions and exceptions. Several exempt masks worn for occupational reasons or in theatrical or festival situations like Halloween. A few make exceptions for religious face coverings. Some, but not all, have included exemptions for masks worn for medical or public health reasons. Some anti-mask laws, like that in California or the one defeated in Oregon in early 2020, applied only in connection with other criminal charges, although those charges might be for things as minor as jaywalking or as contingent as being present when police declared an event to be a riot. Other anti-mask laws, like the one in Alabama, banned simply remaining in public while masked. New York's law made it illegal for two or more people to congregate in public while masked, and was used in 2011 against Occupy Wall Street protesters. Arguments in favor of these laws suggest that wearing masks emboldens people to commit crimes and makes those crimes more frightening to the victims, a view I confess I find appealing if I think of them as anti-Klan laws. But even without considering the question of public health, I am more persuaded by arguments against them. As legal scholars have argued, and courts have occasionally found, they violate rights to privacy, expression, and assembly, and thus the First and 14th Amendments to the Constitution. Moreover, they discourage political protest, extend police power, and are disproportionately directed at left and progressive protesters, as recently as 2019 against those protesting racism and police violence. And of course, they are disparately applied in racist ways and encourage harassment. People of color have been racially profiled for mask wearing in public places, even in times and places where anti-mask laws were not in effect and the public health emergency was. Jules Jill Peterson points out that anti-mask laws are a kind of status law, prohibiting some people from just existing in public, like the ugly laws that prohibited the public presence of people with visible disabilities, or like the criminalization of being unhoused. Laws about apparel have a particularly long history, from ancient sumptuary laws regulating social hierarchy so that commoners weren't allowed to dress like aristocrats, for instance, through cross-dressing laws that were part of the pattern of police harassment that led to the Stonewall Uprising, now commemorated in Pride Month celebrations. In 2020, after the CDC recommended wearing face coverings to prevent transmission of COVID-19, and many places mandated them in certain areas, New York State and the District of Columbia repealed their anti-mask laws, while other states amended their laws or suspended their enforcement. But now, like anti-drag laws and other status offenses, they're making a comeback. In May, the Ohio Attorney General notified public universities that anti-genocide protesters could be charged with felonies under that state's anti-mask law. And anti-mask regulations have also been used against student protesters in Florida and Texas. Police have been recorded forcibly removing masks from handcuffed protesters in California. In the U.S. House, the federal Unmasking Antifa bill, first introduced in 2018, was reintroduced by its original sponsor, who is now positioning it in relation to Palestinian solidarity protests. Earlier this month, veto-proof numbers of North Carolina legislators passed a revision of their anti-mask law. The new version removes a previous exception for ensuring the physical health or safety of the wearer or others, and as a purported concession replaces it with an exception for preventing the spread of contagious disease, which leaves North Carolinians with few legal options in case of wildfire, for instance. Moreover, while the previous law allowed police to demand removal of any mask at a traffic stop or with reasonable suspicion or probable cause, the new law allows any occupant of public or private property to require temporary removal of a mask for identification of the wearer, and allows police to require removal of the mask apparently for any reason or none. That is, in an unprecedented move, it gives every person in North Carolina the legal right to tell those around them to unmask. As one reporter quipped, North Carolina's ban conveniently doubles as a ban on grocery shopping for the immunocompromised. Regardless of how this law might be officially enforced, it has already sanctioned harassment and intimidation of people in masks. Even before the bill was finalized, a stage 4 cancer patient was harassed and coughed at for wearing a respirator mask by a stranger who falsely told her that wearing a mask is illegal and said he hopes the cancer kills her. In New York, where two new anti-mask bills are pending, the governor told CNN that she supports reintroducing anti-mask law because anti-genocide protesters are so scary. The arguments for these anti-mask laws tend to focus on facial recognition, and the rise of invasive electronic surveillance in all areas of life is a real problem that we need ways to resist. But while a face mask might make it a little harder to identify someone, it does not make it impossible. Researchers have determined that face masks are actually less effective than sunglasses are at obscuring someone's identity, though I haven't yet seen any moves to make sunglasses illegal. Pro-Palestinian protesters might well be masking to reduce the real dangers of doxing and harassment, but that wouldn't explain why so many of them are also testing and talking about the need for pandemic solidarity. As Julia Doubleday, among others, has noted, there are lots of good reasons to wear a mask to a protest. People in the U.S. are still dying of COVID more than from any other infectious disease, as well as dying from other ailments it can cause or exacerbate. It's a multi-system inflammatory disease and causes immune damage that makes us more vulnerable to other illnesses. And the risks increase with every reinfection. COVID can spread outdoors. It can spread from those without any symptoms. Masks work to reduce those risks, and they work best when everyone is wearing them and keeping infection out of the air we breathe. We are all at risk ourselves, and we all pose risks to other people. Moreover, as the People's CDC reminds us, more people wearing masks reduces the stigma of mitigation, demonstrates solidarity, and shows our opposition to the fascism of mask bans. There is safety in numbers. If you stopped masking in public, this is a great time to start again. If you're organizing an event, particularly a political event, you can require and distribute high-quality masks for all. You can contact MaskBlock PDX to get masks, get involved, or find a mask block near you. And you can contact your elected officials to protest any mask bans present or proposed in your area, and contact the North Carolina Chamber of Commerce to tell them why you will not be vacationing there. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this has been Fran Michel, encouraging you to wear a mask. You may get so sick that you will not get sick again. You may give your sickness to your family and friends.
That was Sickness by the Donner Party, and before that, you were listening to Fran Michel speaking about mask bans and COVID-19. This is Desiree Helgers, and I'm your host for today's Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Next up is Ash DeBuse, a student organizer with the Collective for Social and Environmental Justice at Washington State University, Vancouver. Ash is majoring in environmental science with dual majors in queer studies and women's gender and sexuality studies. They're a self-described queer, transgender, fat, disabled community organizer who believes that the only way to a just future is through solidarity. Ash argues that the U.S. is witnessing an unfolding genocide against trans people.
With states introducing legislation that would remove transgender children from their parents, that would criminalize parents for supporting their child in seeking gender-affirming care, that would prevent transgender children and adults from existing in public by preventing restroom access and criminalize their gender expression, there is an active movement to eliminate transgender people in the United States. The United Nations defines genocide by the following. In the present convention, genocide means any of the following acts committed with the intent to destroy, in whole or in part, a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group. As such, killing members of the group, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part, imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group, and forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. It is important to acknowledge the origination of the term and the legal framework of genocide. Raphael Lemkin coined the term, created the original definition, and in that definition, groups were more broadly defined than that in the United Nations definition. In normal life, administrative violence, critical trans politics, and the limits of law, Dean Spade argues that LGBTQ plus advocacy efforts that focus on rights as a framework of safety and liberation are feeding and reproducing the same systems that actively harm queer people. The prison punishment system, for example, directly benefits from bills that codify hate crimes by expanding the reach of those systems that already disproportionately targets queer people, particularly queer people of color. Jules Gill Peterson makes the argument that laws and policies that target trans people have a goal of forcing them out of public life entirely. Gill Peterson recognizes the structural intersectionality, stating that even if every single anti-trans law was defeated tomorrow, the issues of poverty, racism, wage inequality, lack of access to health care, and more would still apply, making a transgender future difficult to achieve. Additionally, Gill Peterson connects the harms of anti-abortion legislation and parental rights to the transgender plight. Through the analysis of traditional queer politics and Black people as queer subjects, Kathy Cohen calls out queer organizations and activists on three things. First, for performative activism, for signing petitions and publishing anti-racist statements while not making efforts towards material changes. Second, for relying on the advancement of legal actions such as incarceration as a means of protection for LGBTQ plus people, which actively serves to harm both the queer community and the Black community. Third, for not including the Black community in queer politics, especially when young Black men operate in the world as queer subjects. Now, genocide is not a new concept or practice to the dominant social and political groups in North America. The United States explicitly has an extensive history of physical and cultural violence with the intent to erase populations and identities, most notably against Native Americans. Physical reduction of populations through slaughter was implemented in state policies and in legislation. Land seizure, enslavement, eugenics, and boarding schools were the dominant tools that facilitated this widespread cultural erasure. Turning now to the anti-trans movement in the United States, we'll begin with transphobic rhetoric. Calling trans people groomers, predators, and pedophiles has surged online in recent years. A report from the Human Rights Campaign found that during the month of January 2022, just short of a million tweets mentioned the LGBTQ plus community alongside those terms. This rise in hate speech has direct consequences offline. As transphobic terms and phrases become more common online, they begin appearing in news and in legislation. While the Human Rights Campaign is not without faults, it has been recording instances of fatal violence against transgender and gender nonconforming people since 2013. Their 2022 report states that at least 34 transgender and gender nonconforming people have been killed in the U.S. since the beginning of 2022, emphasizing that the use of at least is key when some of those deaths may go unreported and others are difficult to identify because they may be deadnamed and misgendered. Of the 335 trans and gender nonconforming people who have lost their lives to fatal violence in the decade between the years of 2013 and 2023, 85% of them were people of color. 83% of them were trans women, and 76% were under the age of 35. Direct acts of terrorism against the LGBTQ plus community is also on the rise. During Pride Month in 2022, 31 members of Patriot Front, which is a white supremacist hate group, were arrested outside of a Pride event in Idaho in possession of riot shields, shin guards, and at least one smoke grenade. And the timing of these attacks are deliberate. On Saturday, November 19th in 2022, the day before Transgender Day of Remembrance, five people were killed and at least 17 were injured in a shooting at Club Q in Colorado. In an effort to erase identity, culture, and history, drag queen story hours specifically have been under attack across the nation. Fort Vancouver Regional Library in Washington has been targeted for ongoing 5 years by a group organizing under the name Keep the Library Safe for Children, calling for the library to stop all LGBTQ plus related programming, calling for the removal of all queer related materials from the library's catalog, and repeating transphobic rhetoric actively during public comments of board meetings. The primary organizer of this group has since been elected to the Evergreen Public Schools Board. And Fort Vancouver Regional Library is not an isolated incident.
No, your mom don't get it, and your dad don't get it, Uncle John don't get it. And you can't tell Grandma, cause her heart can't take it, and she might not make it. They say don't dare, don't you even go there, cutting off your long hair, you do as you're told. Till you wake up, go put on your makeup, this is just a phase you're gonna outgrow. There's something wrong in the village, in the village. Oh, they stare in the village, in the village. Oh, there's nothing wrong with you. It's true.
This is KBOO Portland. That was The Village by Rabble, and now we return to Ash DeBuse, who argues that the U.S. is witnessing an unfolding genocide against trans people.
Attacks on venues prior to drag shows and story hours have escalated. The legislation targeting trans youth fulfills the following acts of genocide: the intent to destroy in whole or in part, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about physical destruction in whole or in part, and forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. During the 2024 legislative session, the American Civil Liberties Union reported 484 total anti-LGBTQ bills in the U.S. 14 of them were barriers to accurate IDs, so changed names and gender markers. 26 were free speech and expression bans. There were 101 healthcare restrictions, 12 public accommodation bans or bathroom bills, 192 that restricted student and educator rights, 116 that weakened civil rights laws, along with 98 other anti-LGBTQ bills. While the volume is alarming, what's particularly insidious is the coordinated effort. Each bill that is introduced in a state, such as one that opposes critical race theory, shares identical language, as do the bills that target trans kids in bathrooms and in sports, as do the bills that propose a parental bill of rights. A parental bill of rights proposes an opt-in model of education, which denies children the default of benefiting from all education provided to them in public schools. In the case of sexual health education, children would be required to bring a permission form signed by a guardian in order to access this information. In Washington state, Initiative 2081 was passed earlier this year, which is a piece of legislation that is a parental bill of rights, which allows parents to review their children's curriculum and medical records, and also defaults to opting children out of comprehensive sexual health education. The focus on parental bill of rights shows just how few rights children actually have. Children are treated as property rather than individuals who have autonomy and a right to education. Requiring parents to actively enroll their children or opt in to sexual health education in a school they already attend is a ploy to deny children access to their own bodies, as well as any and all reproductive rights, by barring them from the relevant education. There are active movements and even legislation that, if allowed to continue, would remove children from trans families and from trans-supportive families. For example, Texas Governor Abbott ordered state agencies to investigate families that support their trans children, which went into effect on September 1st of 2023, and if carried out, could remove trans kids from their homes and place them with non-supportive and arguably dangerous guardians, thus fulfilling the forcible transfer of children. Policy that targets trans adults appears more quietly than the legislation that targets trans children. In many states, gender-affirming healthcare is under threat by excluding it from Medicaid coverage or by instilling difficult and costly barriers, further restricting access. And even quieter are the policies that impact queer people in prison, who are forcibly sorted into sex categories that don't match their gender and often denied essential hormone treatments, thus endangering their lives. These three aspects of the current anti-trans state, in combination with other existing disparities like the lack of clean water or accessible medicine or accessible housing, create unlivable conditions for queer identities. There's a direct link between discrimination, harassment, lack of support, internalized shame, and self-destructive behaviors that include and are not limited to suicide. The end goal is to eliminate the transgender population by either making them appear cisgender and compliant to the dominant social model, or to ensure that trans youth don't survive until adulthood. With the criteria of all five acts met, there is undeniably an ongoing genocide. While a gut reaction to these incidences and conditions might be to push for further policing and harsher punishments for perpetrators of direct violence, that route would directly cause more harm to already vulnerable communities by pouring more funding into the prison industrial complex that disproportionately targets those communities. As both Spade and Cohen have pointed out, an alternative must be found if trans people are to not only survive, but to thrive. In Gil Peterson's analysis of queer history, she describes the DIY methods that trans folks have used for gender-affirming treatments over the last few centuries, and similarly, illicit methods of providing abortions. While there's recognition that surgeries and medications that are administered by the untrained can be dangerous, there are also active movements and organizations, such as the Plan C Project, that seek to make abortions accessible to all by providing information not only on processes, but also on safe marketplaces where the abortion pill can be acquired. It's not a stretch to imagine digital networks that are utilized by the trans community and likely assisted by allies to also obtain gender-affirming medications and hormones. In Solidarity in Falling Apart, Allison Spurgis analyzes radical Crip solidarity and proposes that we collectively reject the concept of being cured or fixed when we experience trauma, as that concept focuses on a return to being productive and is rooted in neoliberalism. Alternatively, Spurgis proposes a collective fracturing and falling apart for people who have experienced significant trauma. That's the fracturing piece. To create space to share in their traumas. That's the falling apart. And then to perform community care. In this recognition of the violence that's experienced, trans people can recognize that the source of their traumas are not internal. Instead, they are external. And through community and interdependence comes a greater chance of survival. Crenshaw's theory of intersectionality in politics suggests that the survivability of queer people, disabled people, and people of color relies on solidarity, on refusing to be divided by identity politics, and by working together towards a collective liberation. As Audre Lorde said, that you can't fight City Hall is a rumor being spread by City Hall. We can't give in to the rhetoric that circulates despair, especially because it only serves those who seek to destroy us. Maryam Kaba, in her prison abolition work, says that hope is a discipline. And referencing Octavia Butler's teachings, she says that we are constantly changing. We're constantly transforming. We have the opportunity at every moment to push in a direction that we think is actually a direction towards more justice. Adrienne Marie Brown, another student of Octavia Butler, teaches that we have to imagine new worlds that transition ideologies and norms. We first have to imagine a different system, a new world, in order to create it.
You're only shining when you act yourself. Wish I could have learned that before I went through hell.
Lord, I was trying to flip the cards I was dealt.
I was tired of hiding, I had some words with myself.
I said stop trying to be the things that I'm not.
Trying to be the
That was Andy Grammer and the Trans Chorus of Los Angeles singing Damn, It Feels Good to Be Me. And before that, you heard Ash DeBuse arguing that the U.S. is witnessing an ongoing genocide against trans people. When we post the show, we'll post their full presentation. Next up, Patricia Kohlberg reads a book review by Larry Baldwin.
Good morning. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I have the honor today to read a book review by our book mole, Larry Baldwin, about the 2023 novel Sing, Wild Bird, Sing by Jacqueline O'Mahony. It's Ireland, 1849, and a dark blanket of famine lies over the land. Quote, a robin in the house is a pishog. It's bad luck, a curse. When Honora O'Neill's mother was birthing her, a robin flew in the open door and around the room and back out the door. It was in the house only minutes, but that was long enough to put darkness on the room and the people in it. End quote. So begins Jacqueline Mahony's sad but lovely novel, Sing, Wild Bird, Sing. Quote, she was dark-haired and her eyes were very light-colored, and some of the other children called her a Saoga and laughed at her without fear of retribution. She didn't mind their laughter. Worse things had happened to her than being laughed at. Worse things are happening to her now, every day, because of the hunger. End quote. I know precious little about Irish history, but this book enlightened me some, as did O. Maloney's earlier book, River in the Trees. The novel jumps back and forth between Ireland, or Honora's memory of Ireland, and Oregon Territory, which is where Honora runs to when she stows away on a ship bound for America. Quote, the quay, when she first saw it, was black with people. There were people sleeping, fighting, crying, eating, and she felt like shouting out, this is where all the people are. The country is empty because they are all here, falling off the edge of the land. End quote. Honora pretends to be a mute when she stows away. Quote, it was more than useful to be thought of as someone who could not speak. People expected less of her and helped her more. Their pity was only to her advantage. End quote. I won't give away much of the story, but I will tell you, readers, that Honora at first finds not freedom, but servitude as an indentured domestic worker. She is truly between worlds, as even the language eludes her. Quote, to understand what a word meant, she had to translate it first into Irish and from there back into English. But all her life she had been living between languages, and learning what the word meant was the easy bit. End quote. O'Mahony tells us that she wrote the book for the people who set out to walk for help on March 30, 1849. Quote, this book is for them and for the Cayuse people of the Pacific Northwest, who today form part of the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation in Northeast Oregon. The Cayuse are, as they say, still here. The Irish and the Cayuse were banished to wander the world. May their souls and the souls of their ancestors and their descendants find peace in their ancestral homelands. End quote. This is a wonderful novel about losing and finding. Honora is the wild bird, and she learns to sing again with her Cayuse husband. The lyrical prose and the deeply good heart of O. Mahony make this book worth reading and remembering. There are many words in the book that cannot be translated from the Irish, but the context allows the reader to understand. I have been talking about Jacqueline O'Mahony's 2023 novel, Sing, Wild Bird, Sing. This is Larry Baldwin for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and I am Patricia Kohlberg, reading today for Larry.
That was Patricia Kohlberg reading a book review by Larry Baldwin. This is Desiree Helgers, and I've been your host for today's Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Today's show featured segments by Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker, Fran Michelle, Ash DeBuse, Larry Baldwin, and Patricia Kohlberg. Special thanks also to John Nelson, Fran Michelle, and Patricia Kohlberg for technical assistance with today's show. We're going to play out today's show with Andy Grammer and the Trans Chorus of Los Angeles.
One, two, ready, and...
Ooh, ah, ooh, ah, ooh, ah, ooh, ain't got nothing left to prove. Man, I'm finally free. Damn, it feels good to be me.
You're only shining when you act yourself. Wish I could have learned that before I went through hell.
Lord, I was trying to flip the cards, I was dealt.
I was tired of hiding, I had some words with myself. I said stop trying to be the things that I'm not. Trying to be like everyone else, trying to fit inside of that box. Ooh, you've got magic inside my heart. And it's right from the start, help me catch it.
Nothing's worse than being thirsty.
Start living till you kill that shade, so I won't listen to the hate parade.
I know that I'm not everyone's cup of tea.
Some people spit me right out now
when they ask me to leave.
That's when I stop.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM in the Portland area and all over the world at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with